originally from North America, came here to this part of the world about 1970 and has been a member of his spiritual group since then. And if you look at the kind of experience he has had, he is very, very well suited to interpret for an audience like us much of the spiritual thinking and values from a part of the world like this. So that seemed to me to be a very good addition to the program, because we really had never had something that tried to bring in or capture some of the essence of Indian spirituality. So we asked if he might be able to join us today, and I think there was a little rearranging of schedules so that you'd be able to join us. We're very, very pleased about that. And with Radhanath Swami are a few colleagues. Maybe if we could just know who you are for our audience. Do we have a microphone there, Catherine? Here.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Sharon Gannon. I'm from New York City. I'm here because of the grace of Maharaj. And I love to be in his presence to hear his inspiring words in any and all capacity. And so we're just part of his little entourage this afternoon. Thank you very much for giving us this opportunity.
Thank you.
My name is Jules Febre. I'm also from New York. I'm a yoga teacher, and I spend 9 to 10 months out of the year traveling around the world and teaching yoga.
Great. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Narayan. I am a friend and student of Swami Radhanath from California. Very glad to be here. Actually, what brought me here was coming to hold some vigil for a mutual friend of ours that has recently passed, and we observed some special ceremonies for him, and that was the reason of my visit. But I'm also very, very glad to spend any and all time with Swami when I can. It's a very privileged opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you.
And my name is Zach Leary. I'm from California, from Los Angeles, and I am a former digital marketing executive and strategist who's taking the year off to travel throughout India and the rest of the world, and I'm a friend and student of Radhanath Swami.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm Gauranga Das. I'm from IIT Mumbai, and then I met Swami and some of the people, and I was inspired by the mission, and I'm in the Mumbai chapter of the temple here for the last few years.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you. Well, welcome. Welcome to all of you. So I think with that, I'd like to welcome Radhanath Swami to the front of the room. There'll be, I believe, a presentation and then time for discussion, question and answers, and so forth. So please join me in welcoming to the EMBA program Radhanath Swami.
If you don't pay a person what they need to actually feel secure and comfortable in life, then you're not going to get their full creative productivity. But once you pay them that much, no matter how much more you pay them, even if it's hundreds and thousands or millions of dollars more, you do not get even the slightest increase in their creative productivity. But, according to this survey, if you give them a sense of being valued, if you give them a sense of being appreciated for what they're doing, and really make them feel that they're important, the chart showed their creative productivity zooming higher and higher and higher. So ultimately, it's not just about money. It's about care. William Shakespeare, he had written, "If you lose your wealth, you lose nothing." Now, he wasn't a Swami either. But he had a lot of experience and wisdom in the world. If you lose your wealth, you lose nothing. If you lose your health, you lose something. If you lose your values, you lose everything.
Phil was talking about this book I wrote. I would like to share one story with you on this subject, about the value of actually caring. I was a teenager, 19 years old, when I was seeking truth. In the 1960s, America was very chaotic. There was a counterculture. There was a Vietnam War. There was the civil rights movement. And so much of the young generation were really questioning the very basis of the codes of our parents. So I dove quite deep into the counterculture. But after some time, I found that what we were revolting against, we had the same problems. We were just in different language, different hairstyle, different dress. Then I read the words of Gandhi. He said, "You must be the change you want to see in the world." And I marched with the followers of Martin Luther King in the civil rights movement. And I heard Martin Luther King speak that if you do not have an ideal you're willing to die for, you have nothing fulfilling to live for. I wanted to find that ideal. So I left my country because I wanted to see how other people view America, how they view society, how they view God. Because sectarianism, racism, whether it was in the form of all of these types of prejudices, it just made me sick. I saw how religion, rather than uniting people, was dividing people. But I believe there must be an essence that actually we're supposed to be striving for. So I hitchhiked from London to the Himalayas because I had no money. Took about 6 months, and there was many incredible experiences. Before I tell the story I'm going to tell another story. On the way, I was hitchhiking through Afghanistan. Please don't try that anymore. Actually, last year I spoke at the University of London, SOAS, and they asked me to speak about this book, so I told some stories. And one lady, she was about 21 years old, she came up to me afterward, and she said, "I loved your talk, and I really want to read your book." She said, "I am the president of the All UK Hitchhikers Association." And she said, "I want to take a group of my organization to hitchhike exactly the way you did, the same path, through Europe, through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and then to India." She said, "Can you give us some guidance?" I said, "My suggestion is take your group, hitchhike to Heathrow Airport, and then take British Airways to India." But anyways, when I was in Kandahar, which later on became the capital of the Talibans, just after this event, the reason I remember it so nicely is I wrote a little aerogram, a little letter to my parents about it. And I thought they would think I was so cool, but they were worried, like, "What is he doing in this place?" So I was in a little tea stall. And there was no tables. Everyone was squatted on the earthen floor. And everyone was sipping on this Afghani tea. There was about six of us. I was the only foreigner. And then this little boy came in. He was about 15 or 16 years old. He was completely emaciated. He was wearing rags, a ragged, torn up, soiled turban and some cloth on his body. But what really hit me was his eyes. He was blind, and there was nothing covering them. They were swollen. They were awful colors and disfigured. Just looking at him, I was shaken. And he had a branch of a tree he was holding. And one end, he hammered this little tin can. And then he had a wire nailed on one side and the other side. And he started playing it. You know, it wasn't like a guitar or a sitar. It was like boom, boom, boom. And as he was just thumping this one string little homemade instrument, he began to sing about his devotion. He was a Muslim. He was singing about his devotion to God. And his face lit up, and he smiled. He hardly had any teeth, and they were all kind of different colors. He hypnotized all of us practically. We were mesmerized. And I remember looking up at him as I was squatted on this little dirt floor, thinking, he's the happiest person I've ever seen in my life. And my whole conception of happiness of the way I was raised was totally short-circuited. Because I was always told, you're going to be happy if you have a good job, if you have a good education, if you have good health, if you have good family. He didn't have anything. He was in poverty. He was diseased. He had no education whatsoever. But he was happier than anyone I had ever seen. And he was giving me more happiness than anybody ever had given me. So I began to think, what really is happiness? What are we really looking for in life? It helped to open my mind. I continued my hitchhiking, and ultimately I came to the Himalayas. And while I was there, in my travels, I met one sadhu, or holy man. His name was Kailash Baba. He was probably about 250 pounds. He was a really big man. And he hadn't cut his hair or combed it or shaved his beard in 60 years. He was about 75 or something, and he became a sadhu when he was 12. And he was roaming in the forest, just as a hermit. And he took me in like his own son, and I was roaming around with him. And he taught me all sorts of things. He taught me how to live in the jungle, what you can eat and what you can't eat. Because there wasn't any supermarkets. You know, you pick herbs and leaves and plants, and what plants were medicinal. He taught me how to live with our neighbors. The neighbors that I would see were cobras, vipers, leopards, panthers, scorpions, wild boars, and lots of monkeys. He said, if you think you're better than any of them, or if you have any fear of them, they will kill you. You have to see that they are all living beings who are children of God. You have to see how life is sacred in everyone and offer respects to their life. Now, to respect a tiger, it doesn't mean you go and kiss them. You keep your distance because you respect them. But you cannot fear them, and you cannot feel superior to them. You have to honor them. And if you do that,
they will honor you. Now, this was a crash course because they were around me and I was afraid. But because I was with him, just because he had no fear, not because he could fight them, he was fearless because he actually had love in his heart. He had peace in his heart. Just being with them, even they were walking by, I felt fearless. He told me, you are visitors in their home. You have to remember that. He taught me so many things, and I remember thinking, the information he's giving me is so valuable for every aspect of life, whatever I may do in the future. But what was most fascinating, he did not speak a word of English. And I didn't speak his language. He was giving me so much knowledge, so much inspiration, just by his pointing his fingers, his raising his eyebrows, or his speaking another language. And what I learned from that is he really cared about me. If you really care about somebody, then there's a force beyond our own that can empower us to actually inspire them. That was a great lesson. You know, when I was living with him, I remembered my mother. My mother would always teach me these lessons. Our home, we went through many different types of hills and valleys. My parents were born in they were raised in the Great Depression of America, and then they came, they worked, they really had work ethics. And my father and his brother, they invested everything they had in starting a new business. Would you like to hear the business? They became the largest dealership of a brand new line of automobiles in the whole Chicagoland. It was called the Edsel. It was the biggest disaster in automobile industry. My father went into total bankruptcy. He had nothing. And my mother, she was, you know, for about 2 hours every day, she would cut coupons for discounts from newspapers. And later on, you know, by the hard work of both of them, they never complained. Every morning, my father would sing in the shower, because I shared a bedroom with my brother right next door to the bathroom. He would sing a particular song, and he would sing it with such feelings. When April showers come your way, they bring the flowers that bloom in May. He believed to the core of his heart that this storm would actually create something wonderful. Other people who went through what he did, I saw where I was living. They committed suicide. They became depressed. But he was just a simple person. But he had such confidence that the obstacles of life are actually blessings if we take the opportunity that is there. And he was working about 18 hours a day to try to get out of it. And when he would come home, he would always say the same thing to his children. He'd say, I'm working for money like anything, but money is not really what matters in life. What matters in life is love. The love we have for each other. And the love we can give for each other. And my mother, if someone gave her a pearl necklace, or myself, whenever it was her birthday, I would forget. And at the last minute, I would go into the backyard to her rose garden, and I would pluck a rose with the thorns on it and give it to her. And she would cry in happiness. She'd put the rose to her heart and say, "Thank you. It's the thought that counts. It's not the thing. It's the thought." In an evolved human society, people love people and use things. But in today's world, all too often, people use people to get things. Leadership is very much about the values that we give to people by our example. When I was in Assisi about 2 years ago, I read something that St. Francis had spoken. He told his monks, he said, "You should always, at all times, be preaching. And every now and then, when necessary, you should say something." What does that mean? That means our example, our values, are going to be the foundation in which we really influence people. In the Bhagavad Gita, which is the most popular summary of all India's scriptures, there's a beautiful verse. Yad yad acharati stresthas tat tat evitarojana sayat pramanam kurute lokas tat anuvartate. That what people in leadership position do, that will be the standard. The example they set will be the standard by which people follow. From a moral perspective, having a high position, having power, is a tremendous responsibility to society. The next generation, our example is going to be their compass. There was a scientist who told Albert Einstein, he said that the way I see our Western world today, we have created the most incredible boat, but we don't have a compass. That shouldn't be. Because whatever we have, we're getting from society. What are we giving back? And the Gita teaches a very universal principle, which gives us an understanding from a spiritual perspective of what that responsibility is. Bhoktaram jagatapasam sarva lokameheshwaram suratam sarva bhutanam gyatva mam shanti mirchati. In essence, what this beautiful Sanskrit verse tells is the way to be peaceful and the way to bring peace to the world. If we don't have something, we can't give it. Is to understand that we are not the proprietors of anything. Everything is the property of the divine. Everything is the property of God. And I am a caretaker. My wealth, my abilities, my intelligence, I'm a caretaker. And all living beings are our brothers and sisters. Whatever we have, the Gita teaches, we're not the proprietor, we're not the controller, we're ultimately meant to be instruments. Instruments of compassion. Instruments of goodness. Now, the very interesting thing about the Bhagavad Gita, as Krishna, the speaker of the Gita, is telling this, He's speaking on a battlefield. And Arjuna is a warrior who's about to fight a war. So talking about peace and talking about compassion and talking about detachment from ego and selfishness, you know, to speak about it in an ashram is quite normal, but to speak about it in a battlefield? It was spoken in that setting because it applies to all of us in whatever our particular view of life is. To succeed, either in business or in politics or in law or in farming or in spirituality, we have to have determination. We have to strive. We have to have discipline. We have to have goals that we're willing to really fight for. But how do we fight? With humility. With a sense of responsibility. That I'm responsible for the people that I'm leading. Interestingly, in that session with all of these, some of the most successful people in the world at the Milken Conference, I was quite surprised. They quoted Mahatma Gandhi 6 times. And this one particular man who's one of the biggest people in America, as far as business goes and success, he ended his talk by quoting Gandhi. And you know what he said? He said, "There go my people. I must follow them because I'm their leader." He said, that is the motto of his success. To be a leader means to have humility, to have respect, and to serve the people that we are leading. And that type of character, that type of integrity, not only brings real fulfillment to our own hearts, but it can have such an effect on the lives of all the people around us. One of my dearest friends here in India, the Muffat Lal family, I've known them for many, many years. You know, India has changed its policies in business, in trade. And at one time, they were one of the 3 wealthiest families in all of India. They had textiles and petrochemicals and all these things. And the government changed certain regulations where most of the big textile mills went in total bankruptcy. And he was going through a whole reorganization, a kind of bankruptcy situation. And he told me personally, he said, we were finished because we couldn't pay our top employees. But he said, almost every single one of them, even though they were getting all kinds of other job offers, they stayed with the company, even though they weren't even getting paid, they stayed with the company because they felt it was a family. They felt, you have valued and cared for us for all these years. We cannot abandon you when you're in need. And the company isn't what it used to be, but it's going up and up and up and up. Care. And these people, where is their care coming from? The roots of their care is because they have spiritual values. Because they have found something very deep within their own hearts. Real happiness, I'll quote my visit with Mother Teresa long ago. She told me that the biggest problem in this world is hunger. Not hunger of the belly. Hunger of the hearts. People are in anxiety. people are lonely. She said, when the people of the ghetto of Calcutta die in my arms, I see light in their eyes. She said, so many of the wealthiest people and most powerful people in London, in New York, in Los Angeles, in Paris, she said, many of them, I don't see that light in their eyes. Their hearts are starving. The only thing that could give fulfillment to the heart is love. To love and to be loved. And to the degree that love is without egoism or selfishness, to that degree, that love actually satisfies our heart. And whether we're millionaires, billionaires, presidents, emperors, or little swamis, whatever we do, if we can, instead of reaching out, trying to find happiness through one thing after another thing, after another thing, after another thing, if we find that inner fulfillment within ourselves, then we're more highly motivated to do our work as an expression of that inner wealth that we found. One time here in Mumbai, I was speaking at a school of accountants. There was about 400 people in the room. And I gave a talk, something like this. And afterward, I asked for questions, which I'm about to do here. And you never know what kind of questions you're going to get. This one person raised his hand as uninformed as I was, I called on him. And he stood up. As soon as I called on him, everyone in the room, they were all just about to get their chartered or certified accountants' degrees. They all went, and I realized this man is very charismatic. And he's very powerful. He screamed at me. He said, "You have cheated us." I was standing like this. He said, "Everything you said is simply cheating us. I reject you and I reject all that you told us." And everybody was really listening. He said, "What if everybody became a swami like you? Who would run the government? Who would do the trading? Who would grow the food? Who would do the educating?" He said, "Therefore, everything you said is simply cheating." He got a standing ovation for a long time. They were all standing and they were clapping and they were howling, and I was standing there. Now, how do you answer a question like that? I didn't know. I wasn't expecting it, but I said a little prayer. "My Lord, please give me something to say." And then I replied. I said, "My dear sir, thank you for your wonderful question." It wasn't really a question, but thank you for your very nice attack. I said, "What would happen in this world if everyone became an accountant like you? Who would do the banking? Who would run the governments? Who would do the farming? Who would do the educating? If everyone in the world became an accountant like you, there would be a 100% unemployment rate because nobody would need an accountant." I said, "There's a need for politicians. There's a need for businessmen and women. There's a need for lawyers and doctors, and there's a need for farmers, and there's a need for accountants, and there's a need for little swamis like me too." The social body is like a human body. Each part of the body has a very different shape and a very different function. Yes? The kidneys cannot do what the ears do. The brain cannot do what the knees do. The lungs cannot do what the eyes do. Yes? I want to speak, the pancreas can't do what the hands do. They have different shapes, they have different colors, and they have totally different functions. But are they all fighting? You know, communism, capitalism, socialism. Is just the head saying to the belly, I'm better than you, you should serve me? A healthy body is when every part of the body honors and respects what every other part of the body is doing. And everyone is working together. Whether we're the CEO or whether we're in the housekeeping maintenance, whether we're a farmer or whether we're a president of a nation, in every situation, to actually be able to appreciate the value of what other people are offering and to work in harmony with one another, that is a healthy body, and that is a healthy social body. And interestingly, if the body is unhealthy, every part of the body suffers. More than ever before in history, we are living in a global economy. It's critical to the future of the world, which includes us, because we're all little parts, that we learn to honor and respect the values that others are offering. This is a universal spiritual principle. My beloved Guru Maharaj, my spiritual teacher, Srila Prabhupada, he was sitting once in Bombay, and some of the wealthiest people of Bombay were there speaking to him. And they were asking, how is your philosophy going to help us in our business? And he's a Swami, like, he's not like me, I'm trying to be like him. But he didn't have anything. And he answered, he said, I went to America when I was 70 years old from Vrindavan, a holy place in India. 38 days on a cargo ship. When I arrived there, I didn't know anybody and I had nothing. But I wanted to give this wealth of spiritual inspiration. And he said, now, he said, we have temples all over the world. We're publishing tens of millions of books. He said, it's not about me. I just love these people, and I wanted to serve these people, and they're doing everything. And one of the biggest business people in all the country, he came out and he said to the others, we should learn business from Swami. The core, the foundation of values and responsibility to each other on a human and spiritual value is the greatest need of this world. Like those redwood trees, the big trees are depending on the little trees to survive. And the little trees are depending on the big trees to survive. And they understand that. And they reach out to each other. And they care about each other. And that gives them strength. And they grow taller and taller and taller. And that is the great hope that the world desperately needs leaders to give. Thank you very much. If anyone would like to ask questions. Oh, I forgot to tell you something.
I didn't finish that accountant. So I told the story about the body and everybody. And believe it or not, after I spoke those words, I got a louder standing ovation than he did. And even he was standing up and he went like this and sat down and smiled. So if anyone would like to ask any questions, I'll try to answer.
Hello. Hello?
Can I ask a question? Actually, I'm Alexander. I'm from Russia. And in my first education, I'm a medical doctor. And my question is, what is the death?
What is death?
Death. How you perceive this notion? What is in your point of view? Are you afraid of that?
Very esoteric question. I was expecting more business management questions. You caught me off guard. It has links to everything because we all have to do it. What is death? In order to understand what is death, it's important to understand what is life. And in order to understand what is life, it's important to understand what is death. So what is life? Who am I? This is the initial subject of the Bhagavad Gita. When we say, who am I? Most of us will tell a name. I'm Radhanath Swami. I'm American. I'm a male. Whatever. I'm a Swami. But actually, we can change all these things. You can change your nationality. You can change your job. You can change your religion. And with modern science, you can even change your sex these days. But who am I? Who is that unchanging person that's seeing through the eyes? Am I an eye or am I seeing through the eyes? Am I an ear or am I hearing through the ears? Am I a brain or am I thinking through the brain? Am I a hand or am I touching through the hand? Who am I? The Gita explains we are the conscious living force that is within this body, watching the mind. The mind is always changing. When you're a little baby, you're thinking about your mother's milk. You're crying for your mother's milk. When was the last time any of you cried for your mother's milk? That means your mind is totally different. And your little body as a baby is practically totally different. So who is the witness of all these various changes throughout life? That is who we are. And the Gita teaches that that living force is called the Atma. Or what in the Western scriptures would be called the soul. The living force. Na jayate mriyate vakatachin nayat putva bhavitam na bhavuva. That means that the nature of that living force is it is never born and it never dies. It's eternal. Na hanyate hanyamane sarire. Just like an automobile. Some people drive Mercedes, some people drive Ford, some people drive Maruti. Some people drive Toyota. Different kind of cars. But whatever the kind of car is,
What could it do without a driver? It's the driver that sees through the windshield and makes the horn go off and moves, makes the car move. So we are like the driver within the car of this body. The outside of the car is the body, and the inside is like the mind. And at the time of death, according to the Gita, it's like the car is no more usable. But it's not that the driver dies with the car. The driver lives on. And that's a whole story of, according to the quality of how we live, that will be the destination of that living force within the body. And in that sense, it's very important in whatever field, whether we're in medicine or business or whether we're religious, it's important to take responsibility, serious responsibility, and perform our work with morality so that our future is actually auspicious. In one sense, there's no such thing as death, because the elements of the body are never destroyed. They're just transformed. Yes? You're either the elements of the body, the water kind of goes into the water and the air goes into the air, and we become either ashes, or it becomes transformed, you know, from burying, or if birds eat us, then you know what, we get digested and then come out the other side. So the body's just being transformed. And the Atma is beyond all the changes of the body. So this Bhagavad Gita teaches in such a way that we take serious responsibilities for our words and our actions, understanding that it's not just about what I get. It's about how I am developing the future of the true self. And the nature of the true self is Satchit Ananda, eternal, full of knowledge, full of bliss. That is our nature. The nature of the Atma, according to the Gita, is unconditional love for God. And when there's unconditional love for God, there is unconditional compassion for all living beings. If you put water on the root of the tree, that water will reach every leaf, every branch, every flower on the tree. So the real sign of a person who actually loves God is not, you know, how we profess our love, but that we actually have deep humility and deep compassion for all living beings. That is a universal principle. In the Bible, Jesus says the same thing. And the Old Testament tells the same thing. That the first and great commandment is to love God with all your heart, mind, and soul. And what is the natural expression of that love of God? That you will love your neighbor as yourself. And every living being is our neighbor. Even the ecology and the environment around us is our neighbor. And where there's actually the spiritual awareness of love, we become compassionate. We become deeply fulfilled in whatever we do. Now, some people may say that if you have this internal love and fulfillment, then you'll be lethargic and useless in what you're doing. What will be your incentive? I saw in some of the spiritual people I knew, people who worked tirelessly harder than anybody. What's the closest thing to love of God, of the soul in this world? It's the love of a loving mother for her child. The father works for some hours, comes home, goes to sleep. But the mother for a little baby child, 24 hours. Crying, getting sick, taking to doctors,
giving milk, giving food. This, the child is always vulnerable to. One mother told me that she made her one room completely childproof. And then she put her child in it so she could go out and do other things. And the child, within 5 minutes, went to a drawer and found a razor blade. This is mothers. Does anyone work harder than a loving mother? They're not motivated by greed. They're motivated by love. If we're actually performing our work with a spiritual purpose behind it, whether it be medicine or politics or business or industry or law, whatever it may be, if we actually have a spiritual purpose, if we actually have foundational values, and we're actually connecting through religion, through yoga, we're actually connecting to that inner essence within us, that love, then we will have the greatest motivation. More than desire for power or prestige or wealth and profits is the motivating force of compassion and love. And that is perhaps the greatest need of the world. To help people understand their own reality beyond what we call death. Does that answer your question? Death is a transitional state for the eternal heart, for the eternal self. Yes.
Hello, I'm Tilman from Switzerland. Maybe a more basic question after such a long speech. I would be interested, why are you here? Do you think this is because there is a lot of harmony, or that the people are in dear need for more harmony? And maybe also building on this, you said that values and leadership is so important. What is your judgment about the status here in India, looking at the government, looking at the family clans, looking at the oligarchs that we see here? So I would be interesting to hear your opinion.
There's different levels of what. Are you asking why I'm in India, or why I'm giving this talk to you today?
Why are you in India? Do you
okay,
think this is a good
I'm here
environment for harmony, or you
so
want to help to create?
Me. But as far as why I'm in India, it's a very personal and deep question in many ways. When I hitchhiked overland through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, there were so many near-death experiences. People tried to murder me. I was getting diseases I never heard of. It was a very difficult situation. I was mostly alone and I had no money. When I finally got to the border of India, I had to walk for hours through this no man's land between the two enemy nations of Pakistan and India. And when I finally came to the border, in those days, this is 1970, it was just a temporary border immigration stand. It was just some people with rifles lined up with machine guns, because they were enemies, these two nations. And there was a woman behind a desk in a military uniform. And when I looked, I was actually... when Thomas Paine, in his beautiful writing that he encouraged the Americans to fight the Revolutionary War when they were at their lowest point of defeat, he made a statement that if we don't struggle for something, we don't understand its value. We don't appreciate something's value unless we really have to give something for it. And in this way, struggles are a great blessing. Because when we pass through the struggle and we actually gain, it gives us such deep fulfillment.
it comes easily, we don't really appreciate it very much. So I came all the way there. I gave up my home, I gave up my health, and I practically gave up my life. And finally, I'm looking behind this immigration lady, and I'm seeing India. I made it. I'm only a few steps away. She looked at my passport and said, "How much money do you have?" That was the one question I didn't want her to ask. I had a little bag because most of my belongings, you know, when I was running away from people, I left them behind. I just had a little bag. I had, if I remember, 26 cents in about 5 currencies. And I showed it to her. And she said, "You must show me $200 or you are rejected. We have enough beggars in India and we don't want another one." I begged, I pleaded, I cried. She just got more and more angry. The border guards put their machine guns in my face and said, "Go back." I couldn't go back. I was in a no man's land and I didn't have a visa to get back into Pakistan. So I sat under a tree and I cried and I prayed and I wondered, what am I going to do? And I kept going back and she kept rejecting. And finally, there was a change in guards, and a Sikh man was there. And when I approached him, he said, "My commanding officer told me that you are to be rejected. Go back." I wept helplessly. And I said, "I have given up everything and risked everything to learn from the people of your great country. I promise you that someday I'll do something good for your country if you just give me a chance." And he looked in my eyes very intensely for about a minute, studying my heart. And then he put his hand on my head. And he took my passport. And he said, "Sometimes a man must follow his heart. I will give you that chance that you're crying for." And he stamped my visa. And he said, "Welcome to India." The culture, the people, what they gave to me, it was my great yearning that I could try to reciprocate in every possible way I could to give back. Because in my 62 years of crawling around in this world, I've learned this. It's not about what you get. It's about what you give. Whoever we are. That's where real meaning and fulfillment and purpose in life is. Of course, we have to get to give. If we get with integrity. Integrity means to embrace our sacred ideals, even in the face of temptation. Temptation that if I give up my values, I could get so much more. Or even in the face of fear. Fear that if I don't give up my values, I could lose everything. Integrity is to embrace our sacred ideals in any situation. That's leadership. That's where fulfillment comes. And that's where we need a spiritual foundation or a moral foundation. So I received so much, and I consider the greatest honor that I'm allowed to be here and try to give back. Does that answer your question?
Well,
India has everything. Every extreme and everything in between. I've seen in India, when my mother and father from Chicago first came to India, and to this day, they have never seen the culture, the sweetness, the kindness, and the values that, of the people they've met in India. And they're actually very prominent people in the area they live in America. The values, the respect, which is coming from the spiritual roots that are there. And that's there. At the same time, I've seen cruelty, abuse of women, slaughter of innocent animals, a perverted caste system where people on the basis of where they're born, they're tormented and given hardly any chance. Corruption in politics, cheating in business. India has it all. And I've seen also people who are in the secular world, in one sense, working, but working like saints. I've seen business people who are really more saintly than gurus in the Himalayas, many, because they have such values. So everything is here in India. The important thing in any culture is we understand the real values and the real foundation of morality. What was the other things that I'm supposed to talk about? Responsibility. And, you know, our temple, our little temple, the government of India asked us to help feed the children in the schools because they told us that the Minister of Education told us the biggest reason for illiteracy in India is hunger. People would rather go out begging under a mafia boss or work child labor than sit in school starving. If you can feed these children nutritious meals, they'll stay in school, and instead of just being a nuisance to society, they will be very productive, happy, hopeful assets to society. So we started small. Just a few monks and a few householders. And the congregation and other businesses, they wanted to help. And just our little temple is feeding about 320,000 children every day in the ghetto schools of this area. And throughout India, you know, our society is feeding about 1.2 million children every day. And we started a hospital where we do cataract eye camps because the number one reason for blindness in India is untreated cataracts because people have no money. And we do tens and thousands practically of cataract surgeries and putting lenses in people's eyes for free every year. We have an orphanage. These are some of the things we do. But what is the basis? As a Swami, I don't have anything. Just every year I speak in the HSBC Bank headquarters in London, Canary Wharf. And the first time I spoke there, they introduced me, and there was 900 bankers. And I told them that it's very interesting that you're inviting me to speak to you. You are among the biggest best bankers in the whole world, and I have not had a checking account, a bank account, or signed a check since 1969. If you think I have something to offer, here I am. So I don't have much of anything. But whatever little wisdom that I've been entrusted with, I'm trying to share it. And I see that when we all work together, where we have doctors who work together and they started the hospital, and we have people who are working in business and industry, and they're funding and managing all of the feeding of all these children. So we're working together. Because there's a spiritual foundation, because there's the value of compassion, because there's the value of love, all these different kinds of people can unify with that spirit on every level to do good for the world. So that's what we're trying to do in India. Does that answer your question? Thank you.
My question is that while practice of any philosophy, more than any kind of theoretical proof, is actual proof that surpasses everything. Which means the practice of the philosophy in daily life and actual proof arising out of this surpasses everything. And therefore I ask you a very provocative question. Please don't mind. When people look at you and they see that you are a Swami, and then you propagate the philosophy in such a powerful way, would it not be better than to be a part of society? Not that you are not a part of society, but to dress like us, to look like us, and to have a family, and then to practice this powerful philosophy and show tremendous actual proof in society. Would that not be a more powerful way of doing this?
I am what I am. Would it be better if the kidneys had the same shape as the nose? Yeah, every part of the body has a different shape, a different color, and a different function. So, you know, Swamis have their place too. And these are traditional robes that I'm wearing that have been similar for a long time. And people who do dress like you and have hair like you and who fit in very much, we have thousands and thousands and thousands of such people here, right here in Bombay, who are coming to get some spiritual nourishment from little people like me. So we're trying to play our role. Does that answer your question? So if I dressed like you, whether I could be more accomplished? Maybe, but I am what I am. And we're trying to share. Yes.
All right. Hello, my name is Kim. I'm from Denmark. Two topics that have come up a number of times during our time here in India has been waste or the environment, and then of course learning about the spirituality of India. My question for you is, can you help us understand why all this spirituality hasn't led to what you described earlier as love for the environment?
Very nice question. Some years ago I was at the New Delhi airport. I had just led a pilgrimage of thousands of people in a place called Vrindavan, Krishna's home. And I was really tired. And I really had a hoarse voice from speaking so many hours every day for so many weeks. And waiting for a flight, I really just wanted to be left alone. And the minister, the federal union minister for the environment, came up to me. Her name was Maneka Gandhi at the time. She was Indira Gandhi's daughter-in-law. And she challenged me. She said, what are you swamis and yogis and babas doing for the environment? You're doing all your chanting and your mantras and your prayers, but what are you doing for the environment? The rivers are filthy. The oceans are polluted. The air is poisonous. So much toxic waste being poured into the land, and you're doing your mantras. What are you doing for the ecology? So I thanked her for her genuine concern, because she really was concerned. I said, if you have boils on your body due to a blood disease, and you put bandages on the boils, you have to do that, because you have to treat the symptoms. But unless you go to the heart of it, the blood disease, then the boils are going to keep coming. No matter how many you cure, they're going to be another and another and another. So what is the reason for all this pollution in our ecology? The root cause is pollution in the ecology of human hearts. We're out of touch. We're not looking to the future. If we're really thinking in terms of compassion for humanity in a deep way, then we understand that we're all totally dependent on the environment. And in the Vedic scriptures, we understand that the earth is our mother. She's providing everything, and we should honor and respect her as a mother. Because if we don't, all the children are going to have to pay the consequences. So this responsibility, these values, this morality, in whatever position we're in, we're all meant to be leaders. Leading in our life. And in India, and in so many parts of the world, it's a universal principle that many people who follow religions, either they're not aware or they're not really going deep enough to understand that to love God means to show compassion to humanity and to all living beings. And in order to do that, we have to honor and respect the environment. That's a universal principle. And wherever we see that the environment is being polluted, that means we haven't really understood that properly. We haven't gone deep enough. And that's a problem. When there's 1.2 billion people in a little country like India, you have to have some serious values to make things right. And my guru used to tell me that where there's the greatest need, there's the greatest opportunity to serve. So we're trying. Does that answer your question? There's a lack of education. People don't have proper education, the masses, in sanitation and hygiene, and it's coming from the leaders of society. If the leaders of society don't actually, by their example and by their outreach of using their, you know, their means to educate people, then there's a problem. You know, in a civilized society, people who don't have, whether it's food, whether it's education, whether it's spirituality, whether it's medicine, the people who have are meant to help the people who don't have. That's a healthy body of society. But when we don't care to give them those physical and educational needs, the spiritual needs, then there's a great lack. And here in India, there is that lack, and it is a really big challenge. Okay. Yes.
Hello. Yeah. David from Switzerland. Thank you very much for the presentation. First and foremost, my questions relate more to the religious fabric or the different religion actually in India. So we have been quite around in the past few days. We have seen a lot of movements, traffic jams, slums, ambiguity everywhere. And we ask ourselves, what's all this, everything together? So we came to the conclusion that there is a spiritual aspect into this, and that's what we are discussing today. But what are the different religions and what kind of value are shared? Because obviously it works in this country, and in other countries it's more a source of conflict and problems.
When we seek the essence of our religion, we find that same essence in all religions. A saintly person, whether they are Hindus or Christians or Muslims or Jains or Jews or Sikhs or Parsis, they have values. The value of compassion. The value of actually loving God and treating all living beings as our neighbors. The value of humility. The value of forgiveness. Even while working hard and having great challenges and meeting those challenges. These are our internal foundational spirits. And where we see these qualities in a person, that's true religion. It's not just about the name you call it. My guru, Srila Prabhupada, used to say, religion is not about being a Hindu or a Muslim or a Christian or a Jew or a Jain or a Sikh or this or that. Religion is about loving God and being actual instruments of compassion in whatever we do. That is true religion. And where we find that, that's for real. And it's very important that we educate people in this way. Yes, there was a Russian diplomat who some years ago, he spent time in Calcutta. Have you been to Calcutta? The traffic, the pollution. You know, for a Western person to just be dropped in the middle of it, it's quite chaotic. And after being there for so many years, he came to the conclusion, for this country to still be existing, there must be a God. And he was an atheist or communist at the time. He said, I never believed in God, but after living in India, for this country to still exist, there must be a God. There must be a higher power. So, yes, India. India has a great responsibility to the world. To actually... And the brotherhood and sisterhood of humanity. You know, we should all see the problems and learn from the problems and really be serious instruments to positive change. And it all begins by this internal transformation. Yoga, religion, whatever we call it, it's about that internal transformation where we could be instruments of positive change in whatever we do. I thank you so very much for being so patient, being so kind. Oh, one more question.
One last question, I guess. Okay. Well, thank you very much for being here and sharing your thoughts with us. During your speech, you talked about, you know, to be successful, you need determination and you really need to have focus, I guess, in the goals, regardless of the areas that you may be in, right? And I feel like sometimes the context that you're placed, especially in the business world, you know, regardless of the values that you may have, you know, you're surrounded by profit-driven enterprises, if you will. How do you extrapolate the context that you're in and still be successful in whatever you do. I don't know if I'm clear in my question, but I think that, you know, I think that our day-to-day life and the context that we're placed in especially in the business side of things, even though, yeah, there's values there, there's ultimately a continuous drive for money, you know?
You are so clear. Where are you from?
Brazil.
Brazil. Ah. Honored to meet you. This, what floor are we on in this Trident Hotel?
34.
So we're on the 34th floor. And it's a very nice hotel, beautiful furniture, beautiful architecture, beautiful art. But how many people come into this place and say, what an incredible foundation this building has? I'm probably the first person who's ever said it today. But the fact is, the foundation holds up everything. And so much of our life, you know, we're trying to develop our, like the tree, you know, we're trying to grow higher, 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 but we have to think about the roots. We have to think about the foundation, because storms will come. Pressures will come. Where our values, our morality will be tested. And if we have a strong foundation, we will remain strong. So where do we get that foundation? By associating. Satsang means by associating with people who have deep values, who have a deep spiritual connection in their hearts. And to put some time aside every day to actually cultivate that inner foundation of our own connection to the divine, to God, to our true self. And if we give some time to actually cultivate that foundation, then when we go out into a world where there's so much greed and there's so much ego and everything else, we can maintain our integrity. One of the most famous analogies of India is the lotus flower. And the reason the lotus flower is such an important analogy is it usually grows in the muddiest, polluted ponds of water. And even though the water has so much mud, the lotus flower and the lotus leaf remains completely spotless. In fact, if you go to a lotus leaf and put water on it, the water becomes like a little ball and rolls off immediately. And it doesn't even leave the slightest trace that it's ever been there. So to be lotus-like means we could be in a very, very greedy atmosphere, but maintain our integrity, our values, and hold true responsibility and be a real leader. But that's possible only for the lotus flower when its roots are strong. So if we have these strong internal roots, which is the purpose of religion, it's the purpose of yoga, it's the purpose of human life, to have these inner roots of fulfillment, love, compassion, devotion, then we can be like a lotus flower. And we can maintain our integrity, we can maintain our values, and we can progressively make real change and be tremendously successful. But not on the terms of the polluted environment around us, but on the terms of the inner sanctity that we have found within ourselves. And that's all important. And this has been the universal message throughout the ages to humanity. Will be the most important message
forevermore. Thank you.
So it's really been a wonderful honor to have you with us. Thank you. It's been a great privilege. And I know that so much of what you said will stay with us and resonate and give us much to ponder and reflect upon. We have a very small and inadequate token of appreciation, but you think you know what it is. But we choose this book carefully. This is a book by a colleague of mine that talks about secure-based leadership. And when you talk about firm foundations and caring for others and caring in order to allow others to prosper and do well, that's very much what this was about. So we're happy to leave this with you. So thanks to your colleagues who've come. We're glad you were able to share this afternoon with us. And I think on behalf of all of us, this was a wonderful addition to the program and a very important component of what we're here to experience. And I think quite apart from being here in India, for the journey that we are taking, this journey that began 2 weeks ago in Switzerland, and I'll have you with us until November. Did you hear what Swami said about how you will appreciate things more when you work hard for them? I don't know about you, but I noted that because when in those moments when you wonder why we work you so hard, now you will know. It didn't come from me. The wisdom came from here. But thank you. This has really been wonderful. So thank you very much. If you will allow me, I want to tell you, this was not designed this way, but it actually works really, really well. We would like you now to go work in your leadership teams. Okay? And there are two sheets that Catherine is about to pass out. We'd like you to take about 90 minutes, something like that. But you will know when that period ends, and you will know what to do after that. But let me just suggest what these two sheets are. The first one says discussion in leadership teams, and this is a pretty open-ended document that says, what have you observed, what have you experienced that has made you think about things differently, preconceptions, and also thinking in terms of your own actions as a leader. So this is to talk about with your colleagues. And that's what we'd like you to do over these next minutes. And then there's a second one, which we want you to begin to think about. And that talks about contracting. That is, when we leave here in 2 days, you will not be face to face. In fact, we won't see one another until we come back together in Shanghai. And that's okay for most things, except, of course, the Shanghai projects, but also the leadership teams, because we want these to be foursomes that continue and will continue throughout the year. Now, what we've given you so far intentionally may seem like not a lot of guidance. We've given you the NEO, we've given you Stuart Black survey, we've given you some information on peer coaching. It's not a lot, and that's intentional, because if we give you lots of assignments, you focus on the assignments. We don't want you to focus on the assignments, we want you to focus on one another. As the year goes on, we will give you more materials to incorporate into your discussions with colleagues in the leadership teams. But for now, I think we have given you enough for that. So what I'd like to ask you to do, if it's something like a 4:45, take about 90 minutes in leadership teams, find your colleagues, you may go anywhere, this room, lobby, you can figure that out. But then after about 90 minutes, I suggest you come back here and then you organize yourselves into your ICPs. And you have the rest of today. We won't have anything more to contribute to you on that, but the rest of today, and you have this room to work on your ICPs. And then tomorrow, I'd like you here, ready to go, please, at 8 o'clock. When we start at 8 tomorrow, we'll do a little update on learning journals. We'll have a little conversation about the rest of the program. Then we have our speaker tomorrow at 8:30, and as of 10 tomorrow, you're back in ICPs for the final work on presentations. But these next 90 minutes are dedicated to work in leadership teams, and we encourage you to take full advantage of that. Fair enough? Okay, Matt.
So one small thing. People were asking about photographs. There's 8 gigabytes of photos here. They're going to be on the table over there. If you do download your computer, it takes about 25 or 30 minutes, so they're in folders, but it'll be there. When you finish with it, please put it back on the table for the other people, okay? Thanks.